But he had not time to realize that the colonel had been killed, that the soldier shouting brothers was a prisoner, and that another man had been bayoneted in the back before his eyes, for hardly had he run into the redoubt before a thin, sallow-faced, perspiring man in a blue uniform rushed on him, sword in hand, shouting something. Instinctively guarding against the shock, for they had been running together at full speed before they saw one another, Pierre put out his hands and seized the man, a French officer, by the shoulder with one hand and by the throat with the other. The officer, dropping his sword, seized Pierre by his collar. For some seconds they gazed with frightened eyes at one another's unfamiliar faces, and both were perplexed at what they had done and what they were to do next. "Am I taken prisoner, or have I taken him prisoner?" each was thinking. But the French officer was evidently more inclined to think he had been taken prisoner, because Pierre's strong hand, impelled by instinctive fear, squeezed his throat ever tighter and tighter. The Frenchman was about to say something, when just above their heads, terrible and low, a cannonball whistled, and it seemed to Pierre that the French officer's head had been torn off, so swiftly had he ducked it. Pierre, too, bent his head and let his hands fall. Without further thought as to who had taken whom prisoner, the Frenchman ran back to the battery, and Pierre ran down the slope, stumbling over the dead and wounded who had seemed to him caught at his feet. But before he reached the foot of the knoll, he was met by a dense crowd of Russian soldiers, who, stumbling, tripping up, and shouting, ran merrily and wildly toward the battery. This was the attack for which Yermolov claimed the credit, declaring that only his courage and good luck made such a feat possible. It was the attack in which he was said to have thrown some St. George's crosses he had in his pocket into the battery for the first soldiers to take who got there. The French who had occupied the battery fled, and our troop, shouting hurrah, pursued them so far beyond the battery that it was difficult to call them back. The prisoners were brought down from the battery, and among them was a wounded French general, whom the officers surrounded. Crowds of wounded, some known to Pierre and some unknown, Russians and French, with faces distorted by suffering, walked, crawled, and were carried on stretchers from the battery. Pierre again went up onto the knoll where he had spent over an hour, and of that family circle which had received him as a member, he did not find a single one. There were many dead whom he did not know, but some he recognized. The young officer still sat in the same way, bent double, in a pool of blood at the edge of the earth wall. The red-faced man was still twitching, but they did not carry him away. Pierre ran down the slope once more. "Now they will stop it. Now they will be horrified at what they have done," he thought, aimlessly going toward a crowd of stretcher-bearers moving from the battlefield. But behind the veil of smoke, the sun was still high, and in front, and especially to the left, near Semyonovsk, something seemed to be seething in the smoke, and the roar of cannon and musketry did not diminish, but even increased to desperation, like a man who, straining himself, shrieks with all his remaining strength. Chapter 33. The Course of the Battle. Difficulty of discerning what was going on. Things take their own course, apart from the orders issued. The chief action of the Battle of Borodino was fought within the 7,000 feet between Borodino and Bagration's flèches. Beyond that space, there was, on the one side, a demonstration made by the Russians with Uvarov's cavalry at midday, and on the other side, beyond Utitsa, Poniatowski's collision with Tuchkov. But these two were detached and feeble actions in comparison with what took place in the center of the battlefield. On the field between Borodino and the flèches, beside the wood, the chief action of the day took place on an open space visible from both sides, and was fought in the simplest and most artless way. The battle began on both sides with a cannonade from several hundred guns. Then, when the whole field was covered with smoke, two divisions, Campan's and Desaix's, advanced from the French right, while Murat's troops advanced on Borodino from their left. From the Shevardino redoubt, where Napoleon was standing, the flèches were two-thirds of a mile away, and it was more than a mile as the crow flies to Borodino, so that Napoleon could not see what was happening there, especially as the smoke mingling with the mist hid the whole locality. The soldiers of Desaix's division, advancing against the Flechers, could only be seen till they had entered the hollow that lay between them and the Flechers. As soon as they had descended into that hollow, the smoke of the guns and musketry on the Flechers grew so dense that it covered the whole approach on that side of it. Through the smoke, glimpses could be caught of something black, probably men, and at times the glint of bayonets. But whether they were moving or stationary, whether they were French or Russian, could not be discovered from the Shevardino Redoubt. The sun had risen brightly, and its slanting rays struck straight into Napoleon's face, as, shading his eyes with his hand, he looked at the Flechers. The smoke spread out before them, and at times it looked as if the smoke were moving, at times as if the troops moved. Sometimes shouts were heard through the firing, but it was impossible to tell what was being done there. Napoleon, standing on the knoll, looked through a field glass, and in its small circlet saw smoke and men, sometimes his own and sometimes Russians, but when he looked again with the naked eye, he could not tell where what he had seen was. He descended the knoll and began walking up and down before it. Occasionally he stopped, listened to the firing, and gazed intently at the battlefield. But not only was it impossible to make out what was happening from where he was standing down below, or from the knoll above on which some of his generals had taken their stand, but even from the Flechers themselves, in which by this time there were now Russian and now French soldiers, alternately or together, dead, wounded, alive, frightened, or maddened, even at those Flechers themselves, it was impossible to make out what was taking place. There, for several hours, amid incessant cannon and musketry fire, now Russians were seen alone, now Frenchmen alone, now infantry and now cavalry. They appeared, fired, fell, collided, not knowing what to do with one another, screamed, and ran back again. From the battlefield, adjutants he had sent out and orderlies from his marshals kept galloping up to Napoleon with reports of the progress of the action. But all these reports were false, both because it was impossible in the heat of battle to say what was happening at any given moment, and because many of the adjutants did not go to the actual place of conflict, but reported what they had heard from others. And also, because while an adjutant was riding more than a mile to Napoleon, circumstances changed, and the news he brought was already becoming false. Thus, an adjutant galloped up from Murat with tidings that Borodino had been occupied and the bridge over the Kolocha was in the hands of the French. The adjutant asked whether Napoleon wished the troops to cross it. Napoleon gave orders that the troops should form up on the farther side and wait. But before that order was given, almost as soon, in fact, as the adjutant had left Borodino, the bridge had been retaken by the Russians and burned, in the very skirmish at which Pierre had been present at the beginning of the battle. An adjutant galloped up from the Flechers with a pale and frightened face and reported to Napoleon that their attack had been repulsed, Campan wounded and Davout killed. Yet at the very time the adjutant had been told that the French had been repulsed, the Flechers had in fact been recaptured by other French troops, and Davout was alive and only slightly bruised. On the basis of these necessarily untrustworthy reports, Napoleon gave his orders, which had either been executed before he gave them, or could not be, and were not executed. The marshals and generals, who were nearer to the field of battle, but like Napoleon did not take part in the actual fighting, and only occasionally went within musket range, made their own arrangements without asking Napoleon, and issued orders where and in what direction to fire, and where cavalry should gallop and infantry should run. But even their orders, like Napoleon's, were seldom carried out, and then but partially. For the most part, things happened contrary to their orders. Soldiers ordered to advance ran back on meeting grapeshot. Soldiers ordered to remain where they were, suddenly seeing Russians unexpectedly before them, sometimes rushed back and sometimes forward, and the cavalry dashed without orders in pursuit of the flying Russians. In this way, two cavalry regiments galloped through the Semyonovsk hollow, and as soon as they reached the top of the incline, turned round and galloped full speed back again. The infantry moved in the same way, sometimes running to quite other places than those they were ordered to go to. All orders as to where and when to move the guns, when to send infantry to shoot or horsemen to ride down the Russian infantry, all such orders were given by the officers on the spot nearest to the units concerned, without asking either Ney, Davout, or Murat, much less Napoleon. They did not fear getting into trouble for not fulfilling orders or for acting on their own initiative, for in battle, what is at stake is what is dearest to man, his own life. And it sometimes seems that safety lies in running back, sometimes in running forward. And these men who were right in the heat of the battle acted according to the mood of the moment. In reality, however, all these movements forward and backward did not improve or alter the position of the troops. All their rushing and galloping at one another did little harm. The harm of disablement and death was caused by the balls and bullets that flew over the fields on which these men were floundering about. As soon as they left the place where the balls and bullets were flying about, their superiors, located in the background, reformed them and brought them under discipline, and under the influence of that discipline, led them back to the zone of fire, where, under the influence of fear of death, they lost their discipline and rushed about according to the chance promptings of the throng. Chapter 34. Reinforcements. Belliard appeals to Napoleon. De Beausset proposes breakfast. Friant's division sent in support. The expected success not secured. Continuous and useless slaughter. Napoleon's generals, Davout, Ney, and Murat, who were near that region of fire and sometimes even entered it, repeatedly led into it huge masses of well-ordered troops. But contrary to what had always happened in their former battles, instead of the news they expected of the enemy's flight, these orderly masses returned thence as disorganized and terrified mobs. The generals reformed them, but their numbers constantly decreased. In the middle of the day, Murat sent his adjutant to Napoleon to demand reinforcements. Napoleon sat at the foot of the knoll drinking punch when Murat's adjutant galloped up with an assurance that the Russians would be routed if His Majesty would let him have another division. "Reinforcements?" said Napoleon in a tone of stern surprise, looking at the adjutant, a handsome lad with long black curls arranged like Murat's own, as though he did not understand his words. "Reinforcements," thought Napoleon to himself. "How can they need reinforcements when they already have half the army directed against a weak, unentrenched Russian wing?" "Tell the King of Naples," said he sternly, "that it is not noon yet, and I don't yet see my chessboard clearly. Go." The handsome boy adjutant with the long hair sighed deeply without removing his hand from his hat and galloped back to where men were being slaughtered. Napoleon rose and, having summoned Caulaincourt and Berthier, began talking to them about matters unconnected with the battle. In the midst of this conversation, which was beginning to interest Napoleon, Berthier's eyes turned to look at a general with a suite who was galloping toward the knoll on a lathering horse. It was Belliard. Having dismounted, he went up to the emperor with rapid strides and in a loud voice began boldly demonstrating the necessity of sending reinforcements. He swore on his honor that the Russians were lost if the emperor would give another division. Napoleon shrugged his shoulders and continued to pace up and down without replying. Belliard began talking loudly and eagerly to the generals of the suite around him. "You are very fiery, Belliard," said Napoleon when he again came up to the general. "In the heat of a battle it is easy to make a mistake. Go and have another look and then come back to me." Before Belliard was out of sight, a messenger from another part of the battlefield galloped up. "Now then, what do you want?" asked Napoleon in the tone of a man irritated at being continually disturbed. "Sire, the prince," began the adjutant. "Asks for reinforcements," said Napoleon with an angry gesture. The adjutant bent his head affirmatively and began to report, but the emperor turned from him, took a couple of steps, stopped, came back, and called Berthier. "We must give reserves," he said, moving his arms slightly apart. "Who do you think should be sent there?" he asked of Berthier, whom he subsequently termed "that gosling I have made an eagle." "Send Claparède's division, sire," replied Berthier, who knew all the divisions, regiments, and battalions by heart. Napoleon nodded assent. The adjutant galloped Claparède's division, and a few minutes later the young guard stationed behind the knoll moved forward. Napoleon gazed silently in that direction. "No," he suddenly said to Berthier, "I can't send Claparède. Send Friant's division." Though there was no advantage in sending Friant's division instead of Claparède's, and even an obvious inconvenience and delay in stopping Claparède and sending Friant now, the order was carried out exactly. Napoleon did not notice that, in regard to his army, he was playing the part of a doctor who hinders by his medicines, a role he so justly understood and condemned. Friant's division disappeared, as the others had done, into the smoke of the battlefield. From all sides, adjutants continued to arrive at a gallop, and as if by agreement, all said the same thing. They all asked for reinforcements, and all said that the Russians were holding their positions and maintaining a hellish fire under which the French army was melting away. Napoleon sat on a camp stool, wrapped in thought. Monsieur de Beausset, the man so fond of travel, having fasted since morning, came up to the Emperor and ventured respectfully to suggest lunch to His Majesty. "I hope I may now congratulate Your Majesty on a victory," said he. Napoleon silently shook his head in negation. Assuming the negation to refer only to the victory and not to the lunch, Monsieur de Beausset ventured with respectful jocularity to remark that there is no reason for not having lunch when one can get it. "Go away," exclaimed Napoleon suddenly and morosely, and turned aside. A beatific smile of regret, repentance, and ecstasy beamed on Monsieur de Beausset's face, and he glided away to the other generals. Napoleon was experiencing a feeling of depression, like that of an ever-lucky gambler who, after recklessly flinging money about and always winning, suddenly, just when he has calculated all the chances of the game, finds that the more he considers his play, the more surely he loses. His troops were the same, his generals the same. The same preparations had been made, the same dispositions, and the same proclamation, "Courte et énergique." He himself was still the same. He knew that, and he knew that he was now even more experienced and skillful than before. Even the enemy was the same as at Austerlitz and Friedland, yet the terrible stroke of his arm had supernaturally become impotent. All the old methods that had been unfailingly crowned with success, the concentration of batteries on one point, an attack by reserves to break the enemy's line, and a cavalry attack by the men of iron, all these methods had already been employed. Yet not only was there no victory, but from all sides came the same news of generals killed and wounded, of reinforcements needed, of the impossibility of driving back the Russians, and of disorganization among his own troops. Formerly, after he had given two or three orders and uttered a few phrases, marshals and adjutants had come galloping up with congratulations and happy faces, announcing the trophies taken, the corps of prisoners, bundles of enemy eagles and standards, cannon and stores, and Murat had only begged leave to loose the cavalry to gather in the baggage wagons. So it had been at Lodi, Marengo, Arcola, Jena, Austerlitz, Wagram, and so on. But now, something strange was happening to his troops. Despite news of the capture of the Flèches, Napoleon saw that this was not the same, not at all the same, as what had happened in his former battles. He saw that what he was feeling was felt by all the men about him experienced in the art of war. All their faces looked dejected, and they all shunned one another's eyes. Only a de Beausset could fail to grasp the meaning of what was happening. But Napoleon, with his long experience of war, well knew the meaning of a battle not gained by the attacking side in 8 hours after all efforts had been expended. He knew that it was a lost battle, and that the least accident might now, with the fight balanced on such a strained center, destroy him and his army. When he ran his mind over the whole of this strange Russian campaign, in which not one battle had been won, and in which not a flag or cannon or army corps had been captured in 2 months, When he looked at the concealed depression on the faces around him and heard reports of the Russians still holding their ground, a terrible feeling like a nightmare took possession of him, and all the unlucky accidents that might destroy him occurred to his mind. The Russians might fall on his left wing, might break through his center. He himself might be killed by a stray cannonball. All this was possible. In former battles, he had only considered the possibilities of success. But now, innumerable unlucky chances presented themselves, and he expected them all. Yes, it was like a dream in which a man fancies that a ruffian is coming to attack him and raises his arm to strike that ruffian a terrible blow which he knows should annihilate him, but then feels that his arm drops powerless and limp, like a rag, and the horror of unavoidable destruction seizes him in his helplessness. The news that the Russians were attacking the left flank of the French army aroused that horror in Napoleon. He sat silently on a camp stool below the knoll, with head bowed and elbows on his knees. Berthier approached and suggested that they should ride along the line to ascertain the position of affairs. What do you say? Asked Napoleon. Yes, tell them to bring me my horse. He mounted and rode toward Semyonovsk. Amid the powder smoke, slowly dispersing over the whole space through which Napoleon rode, horses and men were lying in pools of blood, singly or in heaps. Neither Napoleon nor any of his generals had ever before seen such horrors or so many slain in such a small area. The roar of guns that had not ceased for 10 hours wearied the ear and gave a peculiar significance to the spectacle, as music does to tableau vivant. Napoleon rode up the high ground at Semyonovsk, and through the smoke saw ranks of men in uniforms of a color unfamiliar to him. They were Russians. The Russians stood in serried ranks behind Semyonovsk village and its knoll, and their guns boomed incessantly along their line and sent forth clouds of smoke. It was no longer a battle. It was a continuous slaughter which could be of no avail either to the French or the Russians. Napoleon stopped his horse and again fell into the reverie from which Berthier had roused him. He could not stop what was going on before him and around him, and was supposed to be directed by him and to depend on him. And from its lack of success, this affair, for the first time, seemed to him unnecessary and horrible. One of the generals rode up to Napoleon and ventured to offer to lead the old guard into action. Ney and Berthier, standing near Napoleon, exchanged looks and smiled contemptuously at this general's senseless offer. Napoleon bowed his head and remained silent a long time. At 800 leagues from France, I will not have my guard destroyed, he said, and turning his horse, rode back to Shevardino. Chapter 35. Kutuzov. His rebuke to Voltsogen. An order of the day for an attack tomorrow. The spirit of the army. On the rug-covered bench where Pierre had seen him in the morning sat Kutuzov, his gray head hanging, his heavy body relaxed. He gave no orders, but only assented to or dissented from what others suggested. Yes, yes, do that, he replied to various proposals. Yes, yes, go, dear boy, and have a look, he would say to one or another of those about him. Or, no, don't. We'd better wait. He listened to the reports that were brought him and gave directions when his subordinates demanded that of him, but when listening to the reports, it seemed as if he were not interested in the import of the words spoken, but rather in something else, in the expression of face and tone of voice of those who were reporting. By long years of military experience, he knew, and with the wisdom of age understood, that it is impossible for one man to direct hundreds of thousands of others struggling with death. And he knew that the result of a battle is decided not by the orders of a commander-in-chief, nor the place where the troops are stationed, nor by the number of cannon or of slaughtered men, but by that intangible force called the spirit of the army. And he watched this force and guided it in as far as that was in his power. Kutuzov's general expression was one of concentrated, quiet attention, and his face wore a strained look, as if he found it difficult to master the fatigue of his old and feeble body. At 11 o'clock they brought him news that the Flechers captured by the French had been retaken, but that Prince Bagration was wounded. Kutuzov groaned and swayed his head. "Ride over to Prince Peter Ivanovich Bagration, and find out about it exactly," he said to one of his adjutants, and then turned to the Duke of Württemberg, who was standing behind him. "Will your Highness please take command of the First Army?" Soon after the Duke's departure, before he could possibly have reached Semyonovsk, his adjutant came back from him and told Kutuzov that the Duke asked for more troops. Kutuzov made a grimace and sent an order to Dokhturov to take over the command of the First Army, and a request to the Duke, whom he said he could not spare at such an important moment, to return to him. When they brought him news that Murat had been taken prisoner and the staff officers congratulated him, Kutuzov smiled. "Wait a little, gentlemen," said he. "The battle is won, and there is nothing extraordinary in the capture of Murat. Still, it is better to wait before we rejoice." But he sent an adjutant to take the news round the army. When Shcherbinin came galloping from the left flank with news that the French had captured the Flechers in the village of Semyonovsk, Kutuzov, guessing by the sounds of the battle and by Shcherbinin's looks that the news was bad, rose as if to stretch his legs, and taking Shcherbinin's arm, led him aside. "Go, my dear fellow," he said to Yermolov, "and see whether something can't be done." Kutuzov was in Gorky, near the center of the Russian position. The attack directed by Napoleon against our left flank had been several times repulsed. In the center, the French had not got beyond Borodino, and on their left flank, Uvarov's cavalry had put the French to flight. Toward 3 o'clock, the French attack ceased. On the faces of all who came from the field of battle, and of those who stood around him, Kutuzov noticed an expression of extreme tension. He was satisfied with the day's success, a success exceeding his expectations. But the old man's strength was failing him. Several times his head dropped low as if it were falling, and he dozed off. Dinner was brought to him. Adjutant General Voltsogen, the man who, when riding past Prince Andrew, had said the war should be extended widely, and whom Bagration so detested, rode up while Kutuzov was at dinner. Voltsogen had come from Barclay de Tolly to report on the progress of affairs on the left flank. The sagacious Barclay de Tolly, seeing crowds of wounded men running back and the disordered rear of the army, weighed all the circumstances, concluded that the battle was lost, and sent his favorite officer to the commander-in-chief with that news. Kutuzov was chewing a piece of roast chicken with difficulty and glanced at Voltsogen with eyes that brightened under their puckering lids. Voltsogen, nonchalantly stretching his legs, approached Kutuzov with a half-contemptuous smile on his lips, scarcely touching the peak of his cap. He treated His Serene Highness with a somewhat affected nonchalance intended to show that, as a highly trained military man, he left it to Russians to make an idol of this useless old man, but that he knew whom he was dealing with. Der alte Herr, the old man, as in their own set the Germans called Kutuzov, is making himself very comfortable, thought Voltsogen. And looking severely at the dishes in front of Kutuzov, he began to report to the old gentleman the position of affairs on the left flank, as Barclay had ordered him to, and as he himself had seen and understood it. "All the points of our position are in the enemy's hands, and we cannot dislodge them for lack of troops. The men are running away, and it is impossible to stop them," he reported. Kutuzov ceased chewing and fixed an astonished gaze on Voltsogen, as if not understanding what was said to him. Voltsogen, noticing the old gentleman's agitation, said with a smile, "I have not considered it right to conceal from your Serene Highness what I have seen. The troops are in complete disorder."
"You have seen? You have seen?" Kutuzov shouted, frowning, and rising quickly he went up to Voltsogen.
How dare you?" he shouted, choking and making a threatening gesture with his trembling arms. "How dare you, sir, say that to me? You know nothing about it. Tell General Barclay from me that his information is incorrect, and that the real course of the battle is better known to me, the commander-in-chief, than to him. Boltsogum was about to make a rejoinder, but Kutuzov interrupted him. "The enemy has been repulsed on the left and defeated on the right flank. If you have seen amiss, sir, do not allow yourself to say what you don't know. Be so good as to ride to General Barclay and inform him of my firm intention to attack the enemy tomorrow," said Kutuzov sternly. All was silent, and the only sound audible was the heavy breathing of the panting old general.
"They are repulsed everywhere, for which I thank God and our brave army. The enemy is beaten, and tomorrow we shall drive him from the sacred soil of Russia," said Kutuzov, crossing himself.
And he suddenly sobbed as his eyes filled with tears. Boltsogin, shrugging his shoulders and curling his lips, stepped silently aside, marveling at the old gentleman's conceited stupidity.
"Ah, here he is, my hero," said Kutuzov to a portly, handsome, dark-haired general who was just ascending the knoll.
This was Raevsky, who had spent the whole day at the most important part of the field of Borodino. Raevsky reported that the troops were firmly holding their ground and that the French no longer ventured to attack. After hearing him, Kutuzov said in French, "Then you do not think, like some others, that we must retreat?"
"On the contrary, Your Highness, in indecisive actions it is always the most stubborn who remain victors," replied Raevsky. "And in my opinion..."
"Kaisarov," Kutuzov called to his adjutant, "sit down and write out the order of the day for tomorrow. And you," he continued, addressing another, "ride along the line and announce that tomorrow we attack."
While Kutuzov was talking to Raevsky and dictating the order of the day, Boltsogin returned from Barclay and said that General Barclay wished to have written confirmation of the order the field marshal had given. Kutuzov, without looking at Boltsogin, gave directions for the order to be written out, which the former commander-in-chief, to avoid personal responsibility, very judiciously wished to receive. And by means of that mysterious, indefinable bond which maintains throughout an army one and the same temper known as the spirit of the army, and which constitutes the chief sinew of war, Kutuzov's words, his order for a battle next day, immediately became known from one end of the army to the other. It was far from being the same words or the same order that reached the farthest links of that chain. The tales passing from mouth to mouth at different ends of the army did not even resemble what Kutuzov had said, but the sense of his words spread everywhere, because what he said was not the outcome of cunning calculations, but of a feeling that lay in the commander-in-chief's soul, as in that of every Russian. And on learning that tomorrow they were to attack the enemy, and hearing from the highest quarters a confirmation of what they wanted to believe, the exhausted, wavering men felt comforted and inspirited. Chapter 36. Prince Andrew with the reserve under fire, hit by a bursting shell, outside the dressing station. Prince Andrew's regiment was among the reserves which till after 1 o'clock were stationed inactive behind Semyonovsk under heavy artillery fire. Toward 2 o'clock, the regiment, having already lost more than 200 men, was moved forward into a trampled oat field in the gap between Semyonovsk and the Knoll Battery, where thousands of men perished that day, and on which an intense, concentrated fire from several hundred enemy guns was directed between 1 and 2 o'clock. Without moving from that spot or firing a single shot, the regiment here lost another third of its men. From in front, and especially from the right, in the unlifting smoke, the guns boomed, and out of the mysterious domain of smoke that overlay the whole space in front, quick hissing cannonballs and slow whistling shells flew unceasingly. At times, as if to allow them a respite, a quarter of an hour passed during which the cannonballs and shells all flew overhead. But sometimes several men were torn from the regiment in a minute, and the slain were continually being dragged away and the wounded carried off. With each fresh blow, less and less chance of life remained for those not yet killed. The regiment stood in columns of battalion, 300 paces apart, but nevertheless the men were always in one and the same mood. All alike were taciturn and morose. Talk was rarely heard in the ranks, and it ceased altogether every time the thud of a successful shot and the cry of "stretchers" was heard. Most of the time, by their officer's order, the men sat on the ground. One, having taken off his shako, carefully loosened the gathers of its lining and drew them tight again.
Another, rubbing some dry clay between his palms, polished his bayonet. Another fingered the strap and pulled the buckle of his bandolier, while another smoothed and refolded his leg bands and put his boots on again. Some built little houses of the tufts in the plowed ground, or plaited baskets from the straw in the cornfield. All seemed fully absorbed in these pursuits. When men were killed or wounded, when rows of stretchers went past, when some troops retreated, and when great masses of the enemy came into view through the smoke, no one paid any attention to these things. But when our artillery or cavalry advanced, or some of our infantry were seen to move forward, words of approval were heard on all sides. But the liveliest attention was attracted by occurrences quite apart from and unconnected with the battle. It was as if the minds of these morally exhausted men found relief in everyday commonplace occurrences. A battery of artillery was passing in front of the regiment. The horse of an ammunition cart put its leg over a trace. "Hey, look at the trace horse. Get her leg out. She'll fall." "Ah, they don't see it," came identical shouts from the ranks all along the regiment. Another time, general attention was attracted by a small brown dog, coming heaven knows whence, which trotted in a preoccupied manner in front of the ranks, with tail stiffly erect, till suddenly a shell fell close by, when it yelped, tucked its tail between its legs, and darted aside. Yells and shrieks of laughter rose from the whole regiment. But such distractions lasted only a moment, and for 8 hours the men had been inactive, without food, in constant fear of death, and their pale and gloomy faces grew ever paler and gloomier. Prince Andrew, pale and gloomy like everyone in the regiment, paced up and down from the border of one patch to another at the edge of the meadow beside an oat field, with head bowed and arms behind his back. There was nothing for him to do and no orders to be given. Everything went on of itself. The killed were dragged from the front, the wounded carried away, and the ranks closed up. If any soldiers ran to the rear, they returned immediately and hastily. At first, Prince Andrew, considering it his duty to rouse the courage of the men and to set them an example, walked about among the ranks. But he soon became convinced that this was unnecessary and that there was nothing he could teach them. All the powers of his soul, as of every soldier there, were unconsciously bent on avoiding the contemplation of the horrors of their situation. He walked along the meadow, dragging his feet, rustling the grass, and gazing at the dust that covered his boots. Now he took big strides, trying to keep to the footprints left on the meadow by the mowers. Then he counted his steps, calculating how often he must walk from one strip to another to walk a mile. Then he stripped the flowers from the wormwood that grew along a boundary rut, rubbed them in his palms, and smelled their pungent, sweetly bitter scent. Nothing remained of the previous day's thoughts. He thought of nothing. He listened with weary ears to the ever-recurring sounds, distinguishing the whistle of flying projectiles from the booming of the reports, glanced at the tiresomely familiar faces of the men of the 1st Battalion, and waited. "Here it comes. This one is coming our way again," he thought, listening to an approaching whistle in the hidden region of smoke. "One. Another. Again. It has hit." He stopped and looked at the ranks. "No, it has gone over. But this one is hit." And again he started, trying to reach the boundary strip in 16 paces. A whiz and a thud. 5 paces from him, a cannonball tore up the dry earth and disappeared. A chill ran down his back. Again he glanced at the ranks. Probably many had been hit. A large crowd had gathered near the 2nd Battalion. "Adjutant," he shouted, "order them not to crowd together." The adjutant, having obeyed this instruction, approached Prince Andrew. From the other side, a battalion commander rode up. "Look out!" came a frightened cry from a soldier, and like a bird whirring in rapid flight and alighting on the ground, a shell dropped with little noise within 2 steps of Prince Andrew and close to the battalion commander's horse. The horse first, regardless of whether it was right or wrong to show fear, snorted, reared, almost throwing the major, and galloped aside. The horse's terror infected the men. "Lie down!" cried the adjutant, throwing himself flat on the ground. Prince Andrew hesitated. The smoking shell spun like a top between him and the prostrate adjutant, near a wormwood plant between the field and the meadow. "Can this be death?" thought Prince Andrew, looking with a quite new, envious glance at the grass, the wormwood, and the streamlet of smoke that curled up from the rotating black ball. "I cannot, I do not wish to die. I love life. I love this grass, this earth, this air." He thought this, and at the same time remembered that people were looking at him. "It's shameful, sir," he said to the adjutant. "What?" He did not finish speaking. At one and the same moment came the sound of an explosion, a whistle of splinters as from a breaking window frame, a suffocating smell of powder, and Prince Andrew started to one side, raising his arm, and fell on his chest. Several officers ran up to him. From the right side of his abdomen, blood was welling out, making a large stain on the grass. The militiamen with stretchers, who were called up, stood behind the officers. Prince Andrew lay on his chest with his face in the grass, breathing heavily and noisily.
"What are you waiting for? Come along!"
The peasants went up and took him by his shoulders and legs, but he moaned piteously, and exchanging looks, they set him down again.
"Pick him up, lift him, it's all the same," cried someone.
They again took him by the shoulders and laid him on the stretcher. "Oh, my God! Oh, God, what is it, the stomach? That means death. My God," voices among the officers were heard saying.
"It flew a hair's breadth past my ear," said the adjutant.
The peasants, adjusting the stretcher to their shoulders, started hurriedly along the path they had trodden down to the dressing station.
"Keep in step! Ah, those peasants!" shouted an officer, seizing by their shoulders and checking the peasants, who were walking unevenly and jolting the stretcher. "Get into step, Fyodor. I say Fyodor," said the foremost peasant.
"Oh, that's right," said the one behind joyfully when he had gotten into step.
"Your Excellency, a prince," said the trembling voice of Timochin, who had run up and was looking down on the stretcher. Prince Andrew opened his eyes and looked up at the speaker from the stretcher into which his head had sunk deep, and again his eyelids drooped. The militiamen carried Prince Andrew to the dressing station by the wood, where wagons were stationed. The dressing station consisted of three tents with flaps turned back, pitched at the edge of a birch wood. In the wood, wagons and horses were standing. The horses were eating oats from their movable troughs, and sparrows flew down and pecked the grains that fell. Some crows, scenting blood, flew among the birch trees, cawing impatiently. Around the tents, over more than 5 acres, blood-stained men in various garbs stood, sat, or lay. Around the wounded stood crowds of soldier stretcher-bearers with dismal and attentive faces, whom the officers, keeping order, tried in vain to drive from the spot. Disregarding the officers' orders, the soldiers stood leaning against their stretchers and gazing intently, as if trying to comprehend the difficult problem of what was taking place before them. From the tents came now loud angry cries and now plaintive groans. Occasionally, dressers ran out to fetch water or to point out those who were to be brought in next. The wounded men awaiting their turn outside the tents groaned, sighed, wept, screamed, swore, or asked for vodka. Some were delirious. Prince Andrew's bearers, stepping over the wounded who had not yet been bandaged, took him as a regimental commander close up to one of the tents, and there stopped, awaiting instructions. Prince Andrew opened his eyes, and for a long time could not make out what was going on around him. He remembered the meadow, the wormwood, the field, the whirling black ball, and his sudden rush of passionate love of life. 2 steps from him, leaning against a branch and talking loudly and attracting general attention, stood a tall, handsome, black-haired non-commissioned officer with a bandaged head. He had been wounded in the head and leg by bullets. Around him, eagerly listening to his talk, a crowd of wounded and stretcher-bearers was gathered.
"We kicked him out from there so that he chucked everything. We've grabbed the king himself," cried he, looking around him with eyes that glittered with fever. "If only reserves had come up just then, lads, there wouldn't have been nothing left of them. I tell you, surely..."
Like all the others near the speaker, Prince Andrew looked at him with shining eyes and experienced a sense of comfort. "But isn't it all the same now?" thought he. "And what will be there? And what has there been here? Why was I so reluctant to part with life? There was something in this life I did not and do not understand." Chapter 37. The Operating Tent. Portion of Prince Andrew's thigh bone extracted. Anatole's leg amputated. Prince Andrew pities him. One of the doctors came out of the tent in a blood-stained apron, holding a cigar between the thumb and little finger of one of his small blood-stained hands so as not to smear it. He raised his head and looked about him, but above the level of the wounded men. He evidently wanted a little respite. After turning his head from right to left for some time, he sighed and looked down. "All right, immediately," he replied to a dresser who pointed Prince Andrew out to him, and he told them to carry him into the tent. Murmurs arose among the wounded who were waiting. "It seems that even in the next world only the gentry are to have a chance," remarked one. Prince Andrew was carried in and laid on a table that had only just been cleared and which a dresser was washing down. Prince Andrew could not make out distinctly what was in that tent. The pitiful groans from all sides and the torturing pain in his thigh, stomach, and back distracted him. All he saw about him merged into a general impression of naked, bleeding human bodies that seemed to fill the whole of the low tent, as a few weeks previously, on that hot August day, such bodies had filled the dirty pond beside the Smolensk road. Yes, it was the same flesh, the same chair à canon, cannon fodder, the sight of which had even then filled him with horror as by a presentiment. There were three operating tables in the tent. Two were occupied, and on the third they placed Prince Andrew. For a little while he was left alone and involuntarily witnessed what was taking place on the other two tables. On the nearest one sat a Tartar, probably a Cossack, judging by the uniform thrown down beside him. Four soldiers were holding him, and a spectacled doctor was cutting into his muscular brown back. Grunted the Tartar, and suddenly lifting up his swarthy, snub-nosed face with its high cheekbones and baring his white teeth, he began to wriggle and twitch his body and utter piercing, ringing, and prolonged yells. On the other table, round which many people were crowding, a tall, well-fed man lay on his back with his head thrown back. His curly hair, its color, and the shape of his head seemed strangely familiar to Prince Andrew. Several dressers were pressing on his chest to hold him down. One large, white, plump leg twitched rapidly all the time with a feverish tremor. The man was sobbing and choking convulsively. Two doctors, one of whom was pale and trembling, were silently doing something to this man's other gory leg. When he had finished with the Tartar, whom they covered with an overcoat, the spectacled doctor came up to Prince Andrew, wiping his hands. He glanced at Prince Andrew's face and quickly turned away. "Undress him. What are you waiting for?" he cried angrily to the dressers. His very first remotest recollections of childhood came back to Prince Andrew's mind when the dresser, with sleeves rolled up, began hastily to undo the buttons of his clothes and undressed him. The doctor bent down over the wound, felt it, and sighed deeply. Then he made a sign to someone, and the torturing pain in his abdomen caused Prince Andrew to lose consciousness. When he came to himself, the splintered portions of his thigh bone had been extracted, the torn flesh cut away, and the wound bandaged. Water was being sprinkled on his face. As soon as Prince Andrew opened his eyes, the doctor bent over, kissed him silently on the lips, and hurried away. After the sufferings he had been enduring, Prince Andrew enjoyed a blissful feeling such as he had not experienced for a long time. All the best and happiest moments of his life, especially his earliest childhood, when he used to be undressed and put to bed, and when leaning over him his nurse sang him to sleep, and he, burying his head in the pillow, felt happy in the mere consciousness of life, returned to his memory, not merely as something past, but as something present. The doctors were busily engaged with the wounded man, the shape of whose head seemed familiar to Prince Andrew.
They were lifting him up and trying to quiet him.
Show it to me.
His frightened moans could be heard, subdued by suffering and broken by sobs. Hearing those moans, Prince Andrew wanted to weep. Whether because he was dying without glory, or because he was sorry to part with life, or because of those memories of a childhood that could not return, or because he was suffering and others were suffering, and that man near him was groaning so piteously, he felt like weeping childlike, kindly, and almost happy tears. The wounded man was shown his amputated leg, stained with clotted blood, and with the boot still on. He sobbed like a woman. The doctor, who had been standing beside him, preventing Prince Andrew from seeing his face, moved away.
My God, what is this?
Why is he here? Said Prince Andrew to himself. In the miserable, sobbing, enfeebled man whose leg had just been amputated, he recognized Anatole Kuragin. Men were supporting him in their arms and offering him a glass of water, but his trembling, swollen lips could not grasp its rim. Anatole was sobbing painfully.
Yes, it is he. Yes, that man is somehow closely and painfully connected with me, thought Prince Andrew,
not yet clearly grasping what he saw before him. What is the connection of that man with my childhood and my life? He asked himself, without finding an answer. And suddenly, a new, unexpected memory from that realm of pure and loving childhood presented itself to him. He remembered Natasha as he had seen her for the first time at the ball in 1810, with her slender neck and arms, and with a frightened, happy face ready for rapture. And love and tenderness for her, stronger and more vivid than ever, awoke in his soul. He now remembered the connection that existed between himself and this man who was dimly gazing at him through tears that filled his swollen eyes. He remembered everything, and ecstatic pity and love for that man overflowed his happy heart. Prince Andrew could no longer restrain himself and wept tender, loving tears for his fellow men, for himself, and for his own and their errors. Compassion, love of our brothers, for those who love us and for those who hate us, love of our enemies, yes, that love which God preached on earth and which Princess Mary taught me and I did not understand, that is what made me sorry to part with life. That is what remained for me had I lived. But now it is too late. I know it. Chapter 38. Napoleon is depressed, his mind and conscience darkened, his calculation that few Frenchmen perished in Russia. The terrible spectacle of the battlefield covered with dead and wounded, together with the heaviness of his head and the news that some 20 generals he knew personally had been killed or wounded, and the consciousness of the impotence of his once mighty arm, produced an unexpected impression on Napoleon, who usually liked to look at the killed and wounded, thereby, he considered, testing his strength of mind. This day, the horrible appearance of the battlefield overcame that strength of mind which he thought constituted his merit and his greatness. He rode hurriedly from the battlefield and returned to the Shevardino Knoll, where he sat on his camp stool, his sallow face swollen and heavy, his eyes dim, his nose red, and his voice hoarse, involuntarily listening with downcast eyes to the sounds of firing. With painful dejection, he awaited the end of this action, in which he regarded himself as a participant and which he was unable to arrest. A personal human feeling, for a brief moment, got the better of the artificial phantasm of life he had served so long. He felt in his own person the sufferings and death he had witnessed on the battlefield. The heaviness of his head and chest reminded him of the possibility of suffering and death for himself. At that moment, he did not desire Moscow or victory or glory. What need had he for any more glory? The one thing he wished for was rest, tranquility, and freedom. But when he had been on the Semyonovsk Heights,
the artillery commander had proposed to him to bring several batteries of artillery up to those heights to strengthen the fire on the Russian troops crowded in front of Kniazkovo. Napoleon had assented and had given orders that news should be brought him of the effect those batteries produced. An adjutant came now to inform him that the fire of 200 guns had been concentrated on the Russians as he had ordered, but that they still held their ground. "Our fire is mowing them down by rows, but still they hold on," said the adjutant. "They want more," said Napoleon in a hoarse voice. "Sire?" asked the adjutant, who had not heard the remark. "They want more," croaked Napoleon, frowning. "Let them have it." Even before he gave that order, the thing he did not desire, and for which he gave the order only because he thought it was expected of him, was being done, and he fell back into that artificial realm of imaginary greatness, and again, as a horse walking a treadmill thinks it is doing something for itself, he submissively fulfilled the cruel, sad, gloomy, and inhuman role predestined for him. And not for that day and hour alone were the mind and conscience darkened of this man on whom the responsibility for what was happening lay more than on all the others who took part in it. Never to the end of his life could he understand goodness, beauty, or truth, or the significance of his actions which were too contrary to goodness and truth, too remote from everything human, for him ever to be able to grasp their meaning. He could not disavow his actions, belauded as they were by half the world, and so he had to repudiate truth, goodness, and all humanity. Not only on that day, as he rode over the battlefield strewn with men killed and maimed, by his will, as he believed, did he reckon, as he looked at them, how many Russians there were for each Frenchman, and, deceiving himself, find reason for rejoicing in the calculation that there were 5 Russians for every Frenchman. Not on that day alone did he write in a letter to Paris that the battlefield was superb because 50,000 corpses lay there, but even on the island of St. Helena, in the peaceful solitude where he said he intended to devote his leisure to an account of the great deeds he had done, he wrote, "The Russian war should have been the most popular war of modern times. It was a war of good sense, for real interests, for the tranquility and security of all. It was purely pacific and conservative. It was a war for a great cause, the end of uncertainties and the beginning of security. A new horizon and new labors were opening out, full of well-being and prosperity for all. The European system was already founded. All that remained was to organize it. Satisfied on these great points, and with tranquility everywhere, I too should have had my Congress and my Holy Alliance. Those ideas were stolen from me. In that reunion of great sovereigns, we should have discussed our interests like one family, and have rendered account to the peoples as clerk to master. Europe would in this way soon have been in fact but one people, and anyone who traveled anywhere would have found himself always in the common fatherland. I should have demanded the freedom of all navigable rivers for everybody, that the seas should be common to all, and that the great standing army should be reduced henceforth to mere guards for the sovereigns. On returning to France, to the bosom of the great, strong, magnificent, peaceful, and glorious fatherland, I should have proclaimed her frontiers immutable. All future wars purely defensive, all aggrandizement anti-national. I should have associated my son in the empire. My dictatorship would have been finished, and his constitutional reign would have begun. Paris would have been the capital of the world, and the French the envy of the nations. My leisure, then, and my old age, would have been devoted, in company with the Empress and during the royal apprenticeship of my son, to leisurely visiting with our own horses and like a true country couple every corner of the empire, receiving complaints, redressing wrongs, and scattering public buildings and benefactions on all sides and everywhere. Napoleon, predestined by Providence for the gloomy role of executioner of the peoples, assured himself that the aim of his actions had been the people's welfare, and that he could control the fate of millions, and by the employment of power confer benefactions. Of 400,000 men who crossed the Vistula, he wrote further of the Russian war, Half were Austrians, Prussians, Saxons, Poles, Bavarians, Württembergers, Mecklenburgers, Spaniards, Italians, and Neapolitans. The Imperial Army, strictly speaking, was one-third composed of Dutch, Belgians, men from the borders of the Rhine, Piedmontese, Swiss, Genevese, Tuscans, Romans, inhabitants of the 32nd Military Division of Bremen, of Hamburg, and so on. It included scarcely 140,000 who spoke French. The Russian expedition actually cost France less than 50,000 men. The Russian army, in its retreat from Vilna to Moscow, lost in the various battles 4 times more men than the French army. The burning of Moscow cost the lives of 100,000 Russians, who died of cold and want in the woods. Finally, in its march from Moscow to the Oder, the Russian army also suffered from the severity of the season, so that by the time it reached Vilna, it numbered only 50,000, and at Kalisz, less than 18,000. He imagined that the war with Russia came about by his will, and the horrors that occurred did not stagger his soul. He boldly took the whole responsibility for what happened, and his darkened mind found justification in the belief that among the hundreds of thousands who perished, there were fewer Frenchmen than Hessians and Bavarians. Chapter 39. Appearance of the field at the end of the battle. Doubts maturing in every soul. Only a little further effort needed to secure victory, but such effort impossible. Could Napoleon have used his old guard? The Russians had gained a moral victory. Several tens of thousands of the slain lay in diverse postures and various uniforms on the fields and meadows belonging to the Davidov family and to the crown serfs. Those fields and meadows where for hundreds of years the peasants of Borodino, Gorky, Shevardino, and Semyonovsk had reaped their harvests and pastured their cattle. At the dressing stations, the grass and earth were soaked with blood for a space of some 3 acres around. Crowds of men of various arms, wounded and unwounded, with frightened faces, dragged themselves back to Mozhaisk from the one army and back to Valuyevo from the other. Other crowds, exhausted and hungry, went forward led by their officers. Others held their ground and continued to fire. Over the whole field, previously so gaily beautiful with the glitter of bayonets and cloudlets of smoke in the morning sun, there now spread a mist of damp and smoke and a strange acid smell of saltpeter and blood. Clouds gathered and drops of rain began to fall on the dead and wounded, on the frightened, exhausted, and hesitating men, as if to say, "Enough, men, enough, cease. Bethink yourselves. What are you doing?" To the men of both sides alike, worn out by want of food and rest, it began equally to appear doubtful whether they should continue to slaughter one another. All the faces expressed hesitation, and the question arose in every soul, "For what, for whom, must I kill and be killed? You may go and kill whom you please, but I don't want to do so any more." By evening, this thought had ripened in every soul. At any moment, these men might have been seized with horror at what they were doing, and might have thrown up everything and run away anywhere. But though toward the end of the battle the men felt all the horror of what they were doing, though they would have been glad to leave off, some incomprehensible, mysterious power continued to control them, and they still brought up the charges, loaded, aimed, and applied the match, though only one artilleryman survived out of every 3, and though they stumbled and panted with fatigue, perspiring and stained with blood and powder. The cannonballs flew just as swiftly and cruelly from both sides, crushing human bodies. And that terrible work which was not done by the will of a man, but at the will of him who governs men and worlds, continued. Anyone looking at the disorganized rear of the Russian army would have said that if only the French made one more slight effort, it would disappear. And anyone looking at the rear of the French army would have said that the Russians need only make one more slight effort and the French would be destroyed. But neither the French nor the Russians made that effort, and the flame of battle burned slowly out. The Russians did not make that effort because they were not attacking the French. At the beginning of the battle, they stood blocking the way to Moscow, and they still did so at the end of the battle as at the beginning. But even had the aim of the Russians been to drive the French from their positions, they could not have made this last effort. For all the Russian troops had been broken up. There was no part of the Russian army that had not suffered in the battle, and though still holding their positions, they had lost one half of their army. The French, with the memory of all their former victories during 15 years, with the assurance of Napoleon's invincibility, with the consciousness that they had captured part of the battlefield and had lost only a quarter of their men and still had their guards intact, 20,000 strong, might easily have made that effort. The French who had attacked the Russian army in order to drive it from its position ought to have made that effort. For as long as the Russians continued to block the road to Moscow as before, the aim of the French had not been attained, and all their efforts and losses were in vain. But the French did not make that effort. Some historians say that Napoleon need only have used his old guards who were intact, and the battle would have been won. To speak of what would have happened had Napoleon sent his guards is like talking of what would happen if autumn became spring. It could not be. Napoleon did not give his guards, not because he did not want to, but because it could not be done. All the generals, officers, and soldiers of the French army knew it could not be done, because the flagging spirit of the troops would not permit it. It was not Napoleon alone who had experienced that nightmare feeling of the mighty arm being stricken powerless, but all the generals and soldiers of his army, whether they had taken part in the battle or not, after all their experience of previous battles, when after one-tenth of such efforts the enemy had fled, experienced a similar feeling of terror before an enemy who, after losing half his men, stood as threateningly at the end as at the beginning of the battle. The moral force of the attacking French army was exhausted. Not that sort of victory which is defined by the capture of pieces of material fastened to sticks called standards, and of the ground on which the troops had stood and were standing, but a moral victory that convinces the enemy of the moral superiority of his opponent and of his own impotence was gained by the Russians at Borodino. The French invaders, like an infuriated animal that has in its onslaught received a mortal wound, felt that they were perishing, but could not stop, any more than the Russian army, weaker by one half, could help swerving. By the impetus gained, the French army was still able to roll forward to Moscow. But there, without further effort on the part of the Russians, it had to perish, bleeding from the mortal wound it had received at Borodino. The direct consequence of the Battle of Borodino was Napoleon's senseless flight from Moscow, his retreat along the old Smolensk road, the destruction of the invading army of 500,000 men, and the downfall of Napoleonic France, on which, at Borodino, for the first time, the hand of an opponent of stronger spirit had been laid. Book 11. Date of principal historical event. 1812, September 1st, old style, Kutuzov orders retreat through Moscow. Chapter 1. Continuity of motion. Achilles and the tortoise. The method of history. Its explanation of events compared with explanations of the movement of a locomotive. Absolute continuity of motion is not comprehensible to the human mind. Laws of motion of any kind become comprehensible to man only when he examines arbitrarily selected elements of that motion. But at the same time, a large proportion of human error comes from the arbitrary division of continuous motion into discontinuous elements. There is a well-known so-called sophism of the ancients consisting in this, that Achilles could never catch up with a tortoise he was following, in spite of the fact that he traveled 10 times as fast as the tortoise. By the time Achilles has covered the distance that separated him from the tortoise has covered 1/10 of that distance ahead of him. When Achilles has covered that 1/10, the tortoise has covered another 1/100, and so on forever. This problem seemed to the ancients insoluble. The absurd answer that Achilles could never overtake the tortoise resulted from this, that motion was arbitrarily divided into discontinuous elements, whereas the motion both of Achilles and of the tortoise was continuous. By adopting smaller and smaller elements of motion, we only approach a solution of the problem, but never reach it. Only when we have admitted the conception of the infinitely small and the resulting geometrical progression with a common ratio of 1/10, and have found the sum of this progression to infinity, do we reach a solution of the problem. A modern branch of mathematics, having achieved the art of dealing with the infinitely small, can now yield solutions in other, more complex problems of motion, which used to appear insoluble. This modern branch of mathematics, unknown to the ancients, when dealing with problems of motion, admits the conception of the infinitely small, and so conforms to the chief condition of motion, absolute continuity, and thereby corrects the inevitable error which the human mind cannot avoid when it deals with separate elements of motion instead of examining continuous motion. In seeking the laws of historical movement, just the same thing happens. The movement of humanity, arising as it does from innumerable arbitrary human wills, is continuous. To understand the laws of this continuous movement is the aim of history. But to arrive at these laws, resulting from the sum of all those human wills, man's mind postulates arbitrary and disconnected units. The first method of history is to take an arbitrarily selected series of continuous events and to examine it apart from others, though there is and can be no beginning to any event, for one event always flows uninterruptedly from another. The second method is to consider the actions of some one man, a king or a commander, as equivalent to the sum of many individual wills.